It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its second day of public hearings. We'll recap the latest testimony from members of the Trump campaign and the Trump administration, who said they told then-President Trump that his voter fraud claims were baseless. First, religion plays a big role in the United States. That's no secret. And religious beliefs can influence what we think about politics. One religious group might care a lot about specific political issues, or people of one faith might be more likely to support one party over another. But our next guest says there's a lot we get wrong about the way religion and politics come together, and we see those myths in the media and in public conversations. He says if you look at the data, there's a more complicated picture of how religion and politics relate than you might think. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're religious or not, is there something you think people get wrong about your faith or lack of same when it comes to politics? Is there anything you think people who think differently than you get wrong about those beliefs? Is there a conventional wisdom about religious politics you want to check with our guest on whether it's the real deal? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ryan Burge is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He's also a pastor at the First Baptist Church in Mount Vernon, Illinois. His new book is called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, even before you started this book, you've taken on this role as a go-to person to check data and beliefs about religion and politics. Why? How did you fall into that role?
You know what? If you post 1,500 graphs a year for 3 years in a row about religion and politics, I call it the bat signal. I'll be like out with my kids somewhere and I'll see a notification on my phone. Someone tagged me, "Hey, Ryan Burge, can you check on this for me?" And I'm like, "I'm not on my computer right now. I can't look at the data." But people constantly try to bring me in on the scene to try to fact check other people's statements about religion and politics that they just don't think look right.
Before we dig into some specific myths, why is it important to get this right, to have a better understanding of religion and faith and politics?
Yeah, I just think, you know, that facts are the building blocks, or the foundation pieces of the way we understand the world. And if we, you know, can't agree on the facts, then we can't even agree on, you know, how to approach policy if we don't know what the problem is. If we don't know how big this religious group is, or what that religious group believes, or how they vote, how can we really interact with them in a social way? And the problem is, you know, if you look at the data, we asked Republicans to describe Democrats and Democrats to describe Republicans. They have a completely distorted view of each other. So we always kind of like other the other people out there in society, and we create a misconception in our mind, and we don't like that misconception very much, when the reality is they're a lot more similar to you than you think they are. And once we get to that point, I think we have a lot more, you know, fruitful conversations and good dialogue if we really see each other for how we really are, not how we misperceive each other.
Now, you picked 20 myths here. How did you fall into picking the ones that you chose? What led you to use these as your examples of what we get wrong?
A lot of it was just, I may have a little note on my phone of like stuff I see on Twitter all the time. And I'm like, I need to go into that more. Like I can't do 280 characters and get that and explain that whole thing. But the other thing that was going on in my mind was I wanted to make sure that I busted some myths that made conservatives kind of nervous, but also some myths that made liberals kind of nervous at the same time. Because, you know, being a mythbuster isn't just about making one party or one, you know, ideological viewpoint feel good. It's about trying to describe the world in an objective way, which means that sometimes the left's not going to be happy and sometimes the right's not going to be happy. And my job is to make everyone feel a little bit upset, but hopefully a lot more enlightened when they see what the data says.
We're talking to Ryan Burge about his new book, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If there's something that you know is wrong about how people talk about religion and politics, or if you're wondering, you want a little fact check, Ryan might be able to hook you up. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's get into some of your myths now. Ryan, one, the idea that young people become less religious during or after college. There's a de-religiousizing, if I can make up that word, experience that comes along with college. What does the data show?
Yeah, so there's this, that myth comes, I think largely there was a book or a movie came out called God's Not Dead about 10 years ago, where this evangelical student goes to a public university where there's an atheist philosophy professor. And the entire movie is kind of a conflict between him, the evangelical, and the atheist philosophy professor. He wants the philosophy professor wants the kid to sign a pledge that says God's not dead. And if he doesn't sign it, he can't pass the class. So there's this constant like trope out there. If you send your kids away to college, they're going to leave, you know, perfect evangelicals or perfect, you know, Catholics, and they're going to come back Marxist, you know, quoting Nietzsche atheists. If you look at the data, kids who go to college are actually more likely to go to church than kids who don't go to college. And they're more likely to declare a religious affiliation than kids who don't go to college. If we look at young people, like 18 to 22 year old people today, about 40% of them who are going to college say they're atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. It's closer to 50% of 18 to 22 year olds who are not going to college right now. And there's actually other data that says that, you know, the more you expose kids to other religions actually strengthens their own personal faith that much more. So we really shouldn't be afraid of exposing people to other faiths. It actually makes them stronger.
Here's another one, non-denominational Christian churches. And I got to admit to this, as someone who, you know, talks about religion on the air sometimes and just thinks about it, reads about it, I think, okay, you divide up Christianity by, you know, Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, you've got these well-defined denominations. Everybody's going to end up falling into a category. Well, not so much anymore. What's up with the rise of non-denominational Christianity?
Yeah, I think this is actually a great topic to talk about right now because the Southern Baptist Convention is meeting this week, and every reporter that does religion in America seems to be in Anaheim, California, covering that group, which is an important group. 13.5 million Americans are Southern Baptists. They're the largest Protestant denomination in America, but the share of Americans who are non-denominational Protestant is probably closer to 30 million Americans. So there's twice as many non-denominational Protestant Christians in America as there are Southern Baptists. In the 1970s, only 3% of Protestants said they're non-denominational. And now it's 25% of Protestants say they're non-denominational. And over the last 10 years, the only religious tradition, Christian tradition that grew in America, it wasn't Baptists or Methodists or Lutherans or Presbyterians. It was non-denominational Protestant Christianity. And there's a future, I think, where there are more non-denominational Protestants there are not than denominational Protestants in the United States.
This means something. What does it mean?
Oh, I think it's a radical rethinking of American religion. Because if you think about what religion is, most denominations are very top-down, right? Whether the Catholic Church is obviously top-down, but also the Episcopalians, the United Methodists, and even at some level, the Southern Baptists do have a national structure that they kind of organize underneath. Non-denominational churches are, you know, they're bottom-up, they're grassroots, and many of them were started by pastors who were not pastors at all. They were insurance salesmen or real estate agents or worked in a construction company or something like that. Started a Bible study in their basement. All of a sudden, 2 or 3 years later, they got 300 or 400 people in their church, and they really have no theological training at all. So, you know, we're really losing gatekeepers in American society. You know, there's no credentialing for these kind of groups. And so they all kind of they live independently of one another. And we really can't constrain them in any way. Like denominations used to kick pastors out who were, you know, saying unorthodox or heretical things. There's nobody to come in and kick these pastors out. If their church is growing, that's really all that matters to them.
Abortion has been in the news a lot lately with the leaked Supreme Court draft document, the final deal expected to come out any time now. Really, that's one of the myths you looked at, the idea that most Americans are really at one end of the abortion debate or the other.
Yeah, I think that's the one that it's so difficult to try to poll about abortion because people have contradictory opinions about abortion. There's this great study by Tricia Bruce at Notre Dame where she actually did long-form interviews with about 150 people about the topic of abortion. And she would ask them the same question in a different way at different points in the interview. And she would point out when they contradicted themselves, and they would kind of smile and laugh a little bit themselves, go, I know I'm contradicting myself. Because people don't, most Americans don't have a clear black and white view on abortion. Even people who are very pro-choice, a lot of them have some trepidation, you know, in certain circumstances, like the government paying for it or late-term abortion or things like that. And even people who are pro-life, you know, they're not exactly against abortion in the case of, let's say, rape or incest or severe fetal defect or life of the mother, let's say. Most Americans are sort of in that pragmatic middle where they don't really find abortion palatable, but they understand that some people want to have an abortion or they don't want to restrict that right. So really what's going on with Roe versus Wade is we're trying to put people into far left or far right camps. And the majority of Americans are kind of in that mushy middle, and they really don't want, you know, abortion to be completely legal in every circumstance. They also don't want it to be completely illegal either.
We're talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, with us today to talk about his new book, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about religious affiliations in the U.S., how it fits into the political landscape? Do you have ideas or theories of your own? If Is your community, you think, mischaracterized by other people, by the media, by politicians? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ryan Burge about his new book. It's called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe even your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your faith community, whatever it might be, changing over the years, getting more political, less political, the people you talk to? Have you switched your faith community, the one you go to observances with, to church, to synagogue, you name it, because of politics for some reason? Or do you have a question just about some of the myths our guest is talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan, I've talked to you in the past about the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people who say, yeah, I'm not really affiliated with any particular religion or atheism or agnosticism for that matter. And you write in this new book, there's a lot of misconceptions about them. And one of them is the idea that they are, you know, those numbers have been going up, that's true, but the idea that they're people who abandoned church for the most part or left a religious tradition. What do you see actually happening?
Yeah, that's something that a lot of evangelicals ask me about, is why are people leaving church? And if you actually look at the data, more and more people are not leaving church. They were never raised with church in the first place. You know, for instance, we ask people in surveys, what was your religion growing up and what is your current religion? And, you know, the share of Americans who are raised without religion is going up every year. It's now over 20%. And what we're seeing is the share of people who are raised without religion, who stay with no religion as adults, used to be one third of them stayed nuns as adults. And now it's two thirds of them stay nuns as adults. So we're seeing more and more people entering adulthood. About one in three Americans now enters adulthood without a religious affiliation, when it used to be less than 10% back in the 1970s. So it's not like people are leaving church, you know, at 25, 30, 35 years old. They never had a religious tradition to begin with, and they never really pick one up as they move into adulthood.
Another nun-related myth, again, N-O-N-E, is that the rise of unaffiliated people, religiously unaffiliated, means the country as a whole is generally getting less religious. What do you see actually happening?
I see religious polarization happening. So, you know, the people who are left now are the real true believers. And that's not just evangelicals. That's also conservative Catholics and, let's say, Orthodox Jews and Latter-day Saints and people like that. What we're really seeing in America is sort of the hollowing out of moderate religion in America. We used to have a tradition in America called the mainline tradition, which was about 30% of America in 1975 that are Episcopalians, United Methodist Church, United Church of Christ, folks like that. They were 30% of America in 1975. Now they're less than 10% of America today. Those used to be kind of the bridging churches where people from both political parties kind of, you know, sat side by side in the pews. And a lot of those people became nuns over time, or their kids are becoming, they were being raised with no religion. So now we're having a bunch of very, very religious people on the right side of the political spectrum and a whole bunch of nuns on the left side of the political spectrum. And really no one in that moderate middle that used to build bridges between the left and the right in America. It's just people on the far sides of the religious and political spectrum in America, kind of shooting arrows at each other and yelling at each other and making and thinking the worst about the other side.
An interesting question that reminds me of, and this can generate debate, I think, in the evangelical world. A decent number of people that you and others have surveyed will identify themselves as evangelicals who go to church never or almost never. And then some of the evangelical people you talk to are like, whoa, hang on. You got to show up. How do you square that difference?
Yeah, I wrote a piece for the New York Times that really got a lot of, I think I'm going to, on my headstone, it's going to say Ryan Burge, the guy who talked about never attending evangelicals. but they're a growing force in American evangelicals. So about 40% of people who say they're evangelical on surveys say they attend church never or seldom, which means less than once a year they're going to church. 40% of evangelicals now attend church less than once a year. It was 27% in 2008. So what we're seeing is the word evangelical, which we've always thought is sort of a theological religious term, now in the minds of the average person seems to sort of jump the fence from that theological grounding, and now has a cultural and political implication. And I think for a lot of Americans, they're seeing the word evangelical mean I'm very conservative, you know, politically, but I'm also aligned with Donald Trump, let's say. And we're seeing even non-evangelical groups. Let's say, you know, there's a rising number of born again or evangelical Catholics now. About 1 in 5 Catholics say they're born again. So we're seeing a rise of these conservative Catholics calling themselves evangelical because they like the cultural cachet of what that word means when they really don't think a lot about evangelical, you know, theology or views of Jesus or anything like that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in northern Wisconsin. Lou, hello.
Hi, guys. I just want to say that religion is a man-made construct. What we are more is spiritual. We're in touch more with the spirit side instead of the traditions and so forth.
And if I may ask you, Lou, if I were to survey you, how would you list yourself on a survey asking, you know, what religion do you identify with?
Right now, I am none. I was Episcopalian, not quite from cradle, but for quite many years. And I even discerned to go to seminary. But, the greater power led me on a different path. And I understand why now. I have a better understanding because I have a very good relationship with that greater power. And it's a very spiritual life now instead of religion. Like I say that, you know, it involves so many things that are directed by man, not by the spiritual realm.
Lou, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Ryan, an interesting example of someone who puts herself in that nun category. I imagine this has got to be a category that's kind of hard to study, though, in some ways, because some people might have Lou's exact story. Some might have very different stories.
Yeah, what's interesting about Lou is she's actually telling a story I think is actually running rampant across American society, which is a move toward anti-institutionalism, right? She, you know, she even said it, like, I'm spiritual, but I don't like the institutions around religion. If you ask people on surveys, about 45% of Americans say they're very spiritual, but only 27% of people say they're very religious. Because I think for a lot of people, religion has a institutional component to it, a man-made component to it. They're still very, very religious. By the way, even amongst people who never attend church, they're more likely to say that God exists without any doubt than they are to say that God does not exist at all. So Americans have a stubborn belief in a higher power, even though they've sort of left institutional religion in droves over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. That doesn't mean their belief in God has gone anywhere. I think in actually some ways it's actually become stronger because it's become more about spirituality than religiosity, let's say.
Thanks for that call, Lou. We're talking to Ryan Burge. His new book is called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. One more I wanted to get into, a very direct political tie. In the media, we often look at a candidate, say a presidential candidate's behavior and their expression of religion. Do they go to church? Do they quote scripture? Things like that. And assume that that is going to have an appeal to voters of a similar faith. Not so much.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the media's got to write stories for the presidential candidates for months leading up to the election. And, you know, religion's always a topic they want to kind of dig into. And when Joe Biden won the nomination for the Democrats, the whole narrative kind of switched to, I bet Joe Biden can win back some white Catholics that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. But if you look at the data, Joe Biden actually did worse with white Catholics at every attendance level in 2020 compared to how Hillary Clinton did with that same group in 2016. So, you know, the personal religiosity of a candidate, I think, matters very, very little. The most important thing when it comes to voting is the R behind their name or the D behind their name. That's really what guides almost all voting behavior in 2020 or 2022, where partisanship rules everything. And I think religion, I don't want to talk myself out of a job here, but religion has a subordinate role to partisanship in modern American life.
Another question that with the Southern Baptist Convention you mentioned going on now that you looked at is, okay, some evangelical traditions in particular, some Catholic, and of course the Catholic Church says no women preaching, no women in these official roles running church services. What happens when you ask the members of those congregations what they think?
Yeah, people are blown away by this, but if you ask people, are you okay with a woman, given that she's qualified, you know, preaching behind the pulpit on a Sunday morning, you ask evangelicals that, and over 70% of them say they're fine with that, and it's over 70% of Roman Catholics are fine with a woman priest. So, you know, in the pews, there's not nearly this resistance to female pastors as there are, you know, from the hierarchical structures that exist in both those institutions, the Southern Baptist Convention and the Roman Catholic Church. Americans take very pragmatic views of things like that, and I've done all kinds of work on that data trying to make that support drop, you know, looking, let's say, just at older men or, you know, people who believe the Bible is literally true. And it's almost impossible to find a group where support for women preaching goes below 60%. So there's a lot of widespread support in America, not just, you know, in American society generally, but even in conservative religious circles to allow women to have full access to all leadership roles that men have access to.
In our last couple minutes, what are some questions about religion and politics that you're still trying to figure out how to answer? Data can work for a lot of things. Sometimes it's hard to tease things out.
Oh, man. I mean, where do we start, Rob? There's so many things that keep me up at night. One is, you know, why the mainline collapsed. I brought them up earlier, right? The, you know, United Methodist Church, the Episcopal Church, they used to be these powerhouses in American society, American politics, and now they're really sort of marginalized in every single way. If people were sick of evangelicalism and the conservatism that goes along with that, why did they not leave and join a mainline church, where which are much more moderate, they're LGBT affirming, they have female pastors, they're kind of progressive on social policy. A lot of evangelicals who are liberal should have left and gone to those churches, yet they left religion behind entirely. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That's one. Why did the mainline decline? The other one is, why are people leaving church? I mean, that's one that is like a $1 million question. The problem with that is it's really, really hard to answer those questions. So if I say, for instance, the average Southern Baptist is 20% more conservative today than the average Southern Baptist 30 years ago, the problem is those aren't the same people today as they were 30 years ago. That group's gotten smaller over the last 30 years. So is it the moderates and the liberals that left, or just the people there became more conservative over time? That's a really hard data problem to solve, because you have to use what's called panel data, which where you ask the same people the same questions over a long period of time. It's really, really expensive. It's really, really cumbersome. And by the time you get that data back, I'll be in my 60s and won't want to write about it anymore. So that's just two of many, many that I think about at night, things I can't answer right now.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University and a pastor in the American Baptist Church, with us today to talk about his new book. It's called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the latest testimony this morning from the House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection and the events leading up to it. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new data shows there's the record percentage of 4-3 rulings from Wisconsin's Supreme Court in its term so far. We'll talk to the researcher behind the data about what it tells us about the state's highest court. Now, the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its second televised public hearing this morning, which we aired live here on the Ideas Network. The commission provided testimony from Trump campaign officials and attorneys, along with former Attorney General Bill Barr, who said the former president was told he lost the 2020 election and that his claims of voter fraud were unfounded. The lawmakers on the committee said they intend to use this evidence to help show the connection between Trump and the storming of the Capitol. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to this morning's public hearing? What stood out to you? What questions do you have about what they presented, why they did it? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's currently editor of the Election Law Journal and is affiliated with the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Rob.
What stood out most to you at today's hearings?
Well, a couple of things. One is the committee seems to be laying the groundwork here for a criminal indictment, because one of the key things you have to do with a criminal indictment is to prove intent. And so all of the testimony we heard today from the Republican campaign officials, from Ben Ginsburg, one of the leading election law attorneys that litigates on behalf of Republicans, they all said that Trump knew after the election, his campaign people, the attorney general, were telling him, you lost the election. Yet he persisted in the big lie of trying to claim the election was stolen. And so if you have all of these people who are close to the president, meeting with the president after the election, you know, telling him this is not true, this there is no factual basis for the claims that are being made that the election is being stolen, that lays the groundwork then for saying, well, Trump knew that this wasn't the case, yet he still told his supporters to, you know, to try to stop the counting of the electoral vote. So I think that's the main takeaway from today. Then there was a tantalizing thing at the very end where they threw out for the first time what could be another potential something that could bring a criminal indictment, which is misuse of campaign funds. So this, you know, $250 million that was raised, you know, after the election for the Election Defense Fund, and you had Trump campaign officials saying the Election Defense Fund really wasn't a thing and that the money was just funneled to the Save America PAC, and a very small portion of that $250 million was actually spent on legal fees. And some of this was reported at the time, but this really is something that the committee has not focused on so far, and they kind of just threw it out there at the end and really didn't develop it. So maybe that's something they're planning to come back to in the future.
Well, let's take each of those in turn. Let's start with former Attorney General Bill Barr. The latest testimony that they shared was in a lot of ways the center point of today's hearings. Here's a portion of the video the committee played this morning.
I was somewhat demoralized because I thought, boy, if he really believes this stuff, he has, you know, lost contact he's become detached from reality. On the other hand, you know, when I went into this and would, you know, tell him how crazy some of these allegations were, there was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were.
How significant is it that this is coming from President Trump's choice of attorney general to replace what he was dissatisfied with, who had been seen, I think, as a strong Trump loyalist up to this point?
Well, right. And that was, I think, a really significant point about today, is that everybody who testified today were Republicans. So one thing you often hear from Trump and his supporters, this is a partisan witch hunt. Well, these were all Republicans talking, including, as you say, the former attorney general, who was a very strong Trump supporter throughout his presidency. If you think back to the Mueller report, you know, Democrats were, you know, just chastising Barr at the time for really kind of not quite, you know, throwing it under the rug, but definitely downplaying the significance of that Mueller report in a way that affected, I think, how the public interpreted that. So, you know, you could say that Barr helped save his presidency, you know, during that first impeachment investigation and impeachment. Yet Barr, by the end, had clearly decided that Trump had lost touch with reality. He kept on persisting with the claim the election was stolen, and Barr then resigns, of course, in mid-December because he was just, you know, fed up with how this was going.
You mentioned that this is being set up in a way as a prosecutorial laying out of facts here. Now, this committee can't prosecute. So who is the audience for something like that? Who would look at these false election claims and potentially run with that?
Well, Merrick Garland clearly is the main focus here for the committee, that he's the one in the Department of Justice that would have to eventually, you know, bring an indictment if that were to happen. And Garland, as you know, has been kind of frustrating, I think, to some Democrats, especially on the committee, is a very cautious person, and he would not proceed with any kind of legal action against the former president unless he was quite sure that he had a case that could be won. And so that's what the committee, I think, is trying to do right now, is to lay out that groundwork for him and say, look, we think we have the evidence to go ahead with an indictment. You know, here, go do it.
And we don't often see indictments from the Justice Department of former presidents. Like Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford had pardoned him before it could get to that point after the Watergate resignation. There's a pretty high, no pun on Bill Barr's name, there's a pretty high bar here, right?
Right, no, for sure. And I think it seems unlikely to me, given what we know about Merrick Garland, that he will go ahead, just because it is so unprecedented, and that I think, you know, that especially with the difficulty of establishing intent, you know, that you have to prove to a jury that the President Trump really thought that he, knew that he had lost the election, yet persisted with all these claims. And that's tough to do. And even Bill Barr in his testimony that wasn't played in your clip, but later on in the testimony, he says, yeah, it's possible he still believed this. And, you know, to Barr, this was crazy. And in fact, the campaign manager for Donald Trump, you know, talked about how, you know, they had sort of divided people up into Team Normal and Team Crazy. That's what, you know, Trump's campaign advisor said, you know, I was glad to be included in Team Normal, not Team Crazy. And so people on the inside saw these claims as clearly wrong. But to be able to prove that Trump really knew that what he was saying was false, that's hard to do.
Talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, looking at the second day of public hearings in the House January 6th Commission. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, outside of the legal side of things, the false claims about election fraud in 2020 are a big issue in the midterm elections in 2022. Some of the people who generated those claims are running for, you know, governor of Pennsylvania, for example, where they might have influence over what happens with election outcomes there. A lot of people at the January 6th protests are now running for office in Wisconsin and elsewhere. What does it mean politically to have these Trump insiders, his campaign manager, lawyers, his attorney general, saying we knew from the start that these claims were false? We were telling the president that they were false, even as he kept claiming them after we told him they were false.
Well, one would hope this would start to bring more pressure on the people who can continue to deny the truth about the election, and to then maybe give some more leeway to Republicans who, you know, would like to be able to distance themselves from Trump and to move on, you know, from the election deniers and to, you know, focus on the issues that the voters care about for the midterm elections. And so with all of this testimony today, that might be able to create more space for some Republicans who do want to break with President Trump. But that's going to be, you know, tough for some of them to do, clearly.
And then flipping that around, some Republicans are saying, hey, Democrats, you're wasting your time with this stuff. Year and a half ago, this is old news. Voters don't care about this anymore. Do you think that it's worth in the House, especially if no indictments come out of this, do you think it's worth reviewing this in the way that the House is doing?
Oh, I think it's absolutely essential to keep on trying to convince the public of what happened on January 6th really was an attempted coup, and that this was something that remains a threat to democracy as long as people don't recognize what happened. Because if you don't hold the people accountable who perpetrated the big lie, you open the door for this happening again in the future. And especially, I think a really critical thing that needs to happen, you know, before the midterms is to revise the Electoral Count Act, which is something there is a bipartisan group of senators right now, they're trying to work on a compromise to fix that law that opened the door for all of the potential mischief on the night of the counting the electoral votes, because the law is poorly worded and ambiguous, and it needs to be clarified that, for example, the vice president only duty is to open the ballots and count the votes the way that Vice President Pence decided that was his role. But there were people like, you know, Eastman, the attorney that worked with the president to try to have the alternative interpretation of how the electoral count would proceed, was, you know, based on this other reading of that law, which I think, again, needs to be fixed. So that is another thing on the agenda here. The purpose of these hearings is to try to make everyone recognize this wasn't just a one-off. This is a potential threat to our democracy in the future.
We're recapping day two of the January 6th public hearings with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Were you surprised by the testimony from Trump campaign officials and lawyers and cabinet members in one case? Do you think this testimony should end other efforts to overturn the 2020 election? Does it change how you view election integrity in the United States? Call in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon. With us today, looking at the latest testimony from the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and the events leading up to it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions to what you've been seeing and hearing. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hi, Rob. Love your show.
Thanks.
You know that. So I just wanted to, this really could be considered a question, but I'm wondering if anyone thinks the January 6th committee will present as evidence the pattern of behavior of Donald Trump actually way back, I think it was in 14 when he was doing the Republican primary, when he said, if I lose this, I'll show you how the system's rigged.
Paul,
and that was kind of, I think it's interesting, that sort of timeline there.
Paul, thanks for the call. David, Paul referring to then-candidate Donald Trump in 2016, saying if he lost, it was going to be because of fraud. When he lost the Iowa caucus to Ted Cruz, he claimed there was fraud there too. Is that relevant, do you think, as a pattern of claims?
Well, I think, yeah, Paul's onto something here. And this is something that the committee has talked about and looked into. And I imagine this will be part of their overall case, is that this is something that has been, you know, a consistent message from Trump in 2016, not only when he lost Iowa, but remember after he beat Hillary Clinton, he was claiming there was fraud, you know, because he was upset that he lost a popular vote. So he was claiming there were all these, you know, dead people voting and illegal, you know, non-citizens voting and everything, even in 2016 when he won. And he certainly laid the groundwork in 2020, starting very early on. In March, April of 2020, he was saying the only way I can lose in the fall, when he was behind in the polls, of course, you know, would be if the election was stolen. And that was repeated, you know, dozens of times then over the course of the election. So this is something that was part of the mindset of Trump for sure, is that he's trying to make everyone believe it's stolen, you know, to then be able to make the claim, like on election night when he claims victory, even when we had testimony today from his campaign manager and other campaign people, you know, telling him not to do that because the votes were still being counted. And it was, you know, predicted in many of these states that would eventually go for Joe Biden, that Biden was going to carry those states. But Trump went ahead and declared victory anyway on election night.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Joe joins us now, calling from on the road. Joe, hi.
Hello, how are you gentlemen doing? Thank you for this program. I just want to mention something about, you know, it's very difficult to prove seditious conspiracy in court. But Liz Cheney, a while back, not at these hearings, but at the recent hearings, but she said something like, it is a felony by action or inaction to impede the workings of Congress. And for 3 hours, Trump sat there and did nothing. That, to me, would seem to be very easy to prove in court, and that should be Mr. Garland's focus. Because you don't have to prove intent. All you got to prove is that he was sitting on his fat derriere and did nothing for 3 hours. That's a felony. Convict him of that.
Joe, thanks for the call. David, I think the hours that Joe is referring to there are likely to be the subject of some of the future hearings.
That's right. We didn't have testimony on that today, but Joe's absolutely right. That's going to be a crucial part of the testimony coming up. Right now, they're in that phase of, again, laying the groundwork for, you know, what was Trump's state of mind, you know, right after the election. You know, did he know what he was saying was false? And today we heard testimony from his campaign manager, from Bill Barr, all these other people who were telling him, you know, on election night and for the next, you know, month and a half, that yes, you lost this election. But the idea about what did Trump do after the assault on the Capitol had started, and where he didn't forcefully try to stop that from progressing, that could be itself another criminal act. And we will hear more about that in the subsequent hearings.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Talking to David Cannon about the public hearings today, day two of the public part of the hearings of the January 6th committee in the U.S. House. Back to your calls now. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Hey. One of my favorite authors had a character who talked about someone who had unassailable ignorance, and I think that's what we're looking at. If anything, we're talking about the insanity defense. He's presented over and over with a variety of facts which say the evidence that you're getting is false, and yet he ignores it. Now, is that to me, that's willful ignorance, but not necessarily culpable. I mean, he is psychologically unable to accept the fact, accept these facts as true.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. I had exactly that same thought process today that this all just went through. That either way you take this, Trump is not qualified to be president of the United States, because either, as Bill Barr put it, he's detached from reality, and that's we you played the clip earlier where Bill Barr says that he was really disturbed by the fact that they were telling Trump this over and over again, and he just couldn't accept it. So either it was criminal intent because he knew what he was saying was false, and he was just being strategic about it. Then, obviously, that he's not qualified to be president because he should be in jail. Second would be if he really did believe it, but then he's detached from reality and should not be president because he can't come to grips with the facts in front of him.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Bill now in Superior. Bill, hello.
Hi, quick question. We have in this hearing about the riots at the Capitol. When are we going to have a hearing, do you think, on the riots and the looting that Antifa and BLM were in front of that was endorsed and supported by many Congress people and senators on the left when all that happened? When are we going to have that hearing?
Bill, thanks for the call. David, this is, I think people often try to make an equivalence between the two. What do you think?
Well, I mean, everyone, when this comes up, I mean, everyone always, points out that the violence that happened at some of the rallies in support of George Floyd and trying to, bring some focus on the criminal justice system in this country, will always say that the violence that happened in those cases is obviously something that's deplorable and should not have happened. And we have had a lot of discussion about the various incidents in cities around the country. But this is something quite different. It's a very different category than a threat to our democracy, that the foundation of our country always has been the peaceful transition of power from one political party to the other political party when they lose an election. If we lose that basis for democracy, we no longer will be a country. And so the stakes are so much higher for this, and this is why I think this is so important to keep our focus on this. And Bill is right to raise concerns about other incidents that happened in the past, and those have been discussed and are receiving attention both at the local level, state level, and nationally as well. But it really is a very separate issue that's not sort of directly relevant for the discussion today.
Bill, thanks for the call. David, I want to bring back a phrase you used earlier in the discussion, attempted coup. And some people probably nodded along when they heard that. Some might be like, wait, what? Do you think it's fair to describe what happened leading up to and including January 6th as an attempted coup?
Well, that I was using that phrase because that was Benny Thompson, the chair of the committee's phrase. That's how he described it on Thursday, the opening night of the hearings. He described it in that language of the attempted coup, and that's what the committee is trying to now prove, that this was something that was a concerted effort to stop that peaceful transition of power from one party to the other.
As just our last minute, what are you watching for in the remaining hearings?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that will get more attention. One is, what happened after the start of the assault on the Capitol, and what were the actions of the president? What was his mindset at the time? We did have a couple of brief mentions of that in the opening night of the hearings, where there was a conversation that Trump has said he didn't have, where he said that maybe the supporters are right when it comes to Mike Pence. Maybe that they should hang Mike Pence, and he didn't use exactly the phrase "hang Mike Pence," but it was clear that he was being supportive of the protest of the people who were in the Capitol at the time and when Mike Pence was, you know, really in danger. So I think there'll be more discussion of that, of what were his actions, what was his mindset, you know, on January 6th itself. Whereas right now it's been, again, more the sort of lead up to that.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's currently editor of the Election Law Journal, and he's affiliated with the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. He joined us today to check in on the latest testimony presented by the House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. We'll be airing the rest of those when they resume later this week here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. And coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, get more analysis of the ongoing public hearings in Congress with Kate Archer-Kent and her guest, joining with your thoughts tomorrow morning at 7:30. On Food Friday last week, we invited you to share your advice for other cooks and got lots of great suggestions. We also got an email from Beth in Menominee, who has advice about using recipes from cookbooks and other sources. Beth writes, to start, my cookbook collection is growing. I blame you and your show. If I haven't bought them, they're on the list. I've gotten so many good ones. They read like a novel to me. Also have too many recipes saved to try. Beth's suggestion is for new cooks. Beth says, when you try a new recipe, follow it exactly. If there's something you absolutely don't like, then do change that. The recipes usually are made to give you good results. If you don't like it as given the first time, then feel free to make any changes to suit your taste and make notes. Beth, good advice. I especially follow that when I'm trying a new style of cooking, maybe a new kind of ethnic food from around the world, a new ingredient or whatever. I try to stay close to the letter. Other than that, I tend to play it pretty fast and loose. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.